Let me give you a list of four bills that we're not going to hear that are on the list today, please. Senate Bill 266, 267, 271, and Senate Bill 274. We will put off till later. We're trying to decide what to... possible introduction of committee bills, I would like to submit LC 1926 as a general government committee bill. Do you want to tell us what that does, please, Mark?
Specifies additional conditions under which corporation may be dissolved and authority of foreign corporation revoked. Specifies conditions under which board of directors may be replaced by board of trustees. Directs Secretary of State to adopt corporate code of conduct. Prohibits corporation from holding green permit if corporation engages in certain activities. Allows all action for actual damages for certain securities law violations involving elements of fraud.
Just a little corporate house cleaning bill. Senator Menes moves that we move drafting of that, please, as a committee bill.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, move we introduce LC 1926 as a committee bill.
Okay, so moved.
Okay.
Any objection? Seeing none, all right. Okay. Representative Canope has told us that he's going to join us at 4 p.m. for the PERS discussion. So let's see what we have on some of these other bills. We have nobody there. 269. Okay. Why don't we do, since we have the Deputy AG here, we'll do... is Pete Shepherd here? That's Pete. That's what I thought. Okay. We will do Senate Bill... We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 269. Okay. And would you tell us what Senate Bill 269 does, please, Mark?
Senate Bill 269 prohibits employees of Office of Emergency Management from striking or recognizing picket lines.
Okay, and on our witness registration today, not required to take an oath of honesty, unlike the House, we have Pete Shepherd, Deputy AG.
Here, I just got signed up on the wrong list. 268 is the one that I am
not sure. Okay. Okay, then Mary Botkin, please. I'll just cross you off that one, Pete.
Now he has to wait.
He's not on the other one. Should I just leave? Oh, I see. Okay.
Hello, Mr. Chair. We're all just going to come up here together because this won't take us very long.
Okay.
I am handing out to you as we speak. I'm sorry. For the record, I'm Mary Botts, and I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And we represent the employees of the Office of Emergency Management. And just so folks kind of have a sense of what these people do, they are... This is the agency that is responsible for handling all emergency natural disaster, natural and man-made disaster funds, federal funds that come in from the federal government for emergency relief, and those kinds of programs, and they actually can and do coordinate emergency response for natural or man-made disasters. I've handed out an amendment that we've worked out with the Department of the OEM to narrow the scope. It is our intent to only cover the employees who actually are responsible for emergency response or coordination. And it is, in our opinion, it makes a lot of sense to move that small group of people. And we think there's actually only about 10 people that would be impacted by this bill. But we think it makes a lot more sense to move them out of the more traditional form of dispute resolution and move them into the non-strikeable unit or into a non-strikeable unit, and require that we follow a different form of dispute resolution, which would result in binding arbitration at the end of any disputes or at the end of contract negotiations, if there was not an agreement. Partially because, quite frankly, these folks are not people you want on strike in the middle of a disaster. I mean, you want them on the job. They agree with that. And this just simply provides with a different form of resolution to any contract disputes. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions. Colleen Savage, who is our staff rep for the Office of Emergency Management, is with me.
Oh, I see.
And
sir, you pass these out to the
and if you have any specific questions, she or I will answer them.
Okay. I do have a question.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Ken is here from the department.
And Mr. Chair, I just have a question. I'll just lay out here, and then maybe one of you can answer it. I'm looking at the amendment already. I'm just kind of wondering how you're going to single out which one of these employees fit this category and how that would be accomplished. How would they know among themselves that there's strike prohibited as opposed to others?
For the record, my name is Ken Murphy, and I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Emergency Management, Mr. Chair, and Senator Minnis. Primarily, we have some people that are focused in our Oregon Emergency Response System that deal with the communications aspect, and they are needed 24 hours a day, whether it's emergency or not, and are very critical during an emergency, so we will easily single them out based upon their technical skills and their knowledge of how to make the system of emergency services work in the state. The others are simply that we would focus on possibly our earthquake and tsunami coordinators, and we would have to take a look at the type of disaster that would require, because we are less than one deep in each one of these areas. So depending on the type of disaster, we would select those individuals if they're truly needed in the response and recovery.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Clarification, would you do that by rule?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, yeah, yes, sir.
Mr.
Would it be
Chair,
by rule or by herb?
It may be a little of both.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I've been assured by both the agency and our staff that work with the agency that they don't anticipate having any problems identifying those folks that need to be moved into that category. And I have confidence, as I'm sure you do, that if the agency and the staff that are assigned to that are both comfortable in being able to do that, that it probably will happen easily. And this is not a huge agency. It's not hundreds of people. So, you know, if it was a bigger agency, I think we'd have to be a little clearer. But
okay.
It's not. So, and they have a good working relationship, and we have a good relationship with them. So,
okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, what is the process of getting this amendment drafted? Do you have it in LC?
I don't have it in LC at this point.
So we'll all have
committee staff and I just met yesterday about it, so we'll need to have it drafted before we can probably work the bill.
Okay, so we'll accommodate you on that, and we will close the public hearing. Thank you very much. I'm going to skip around a little. Well, let's go to respect Mr. Shepard's time. Let's go to Senate Bill 268. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 268, please. Mary Botkin and Pete Shepard. I have a funny feeling you won't be showing up together.
I'm willing to
show. Okay. Now, this is like an anniversary for you guys, isn't it?
Something like it.
Hi, Pete. We wouldn't be on the same side.
I understand.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. This bill does primarily what the other one did. It takes the Assistant Attorney Generals out of more traditional bargaining processes and puts them into the binding arbitration non-strikeable process. for dispute resolution. To be very candid with the committee, we know that the Attorney General does not like this bill. And quite frankly, we're at a loss because we don't understand why the more traditional, confrontational ways of settling a dispute are preferable to that office. We think that it makes sense that the state's attorneys are there 24/7 when you need them. And that to ask state attorney generals to kind of be in a confrontational mode with their employer, which can in some cases be you, makes little sense to us. And this really is just an alternative way of settling a dispute and having a third neutral party kind of weigh the evidence in front of them and make the decision. And it is the best argument we can come up with, and the bill has to stand or fall on its own merits.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Pete Shepard. I am the Deputy Attorney General, and first I appreciate the Chair's courtesy in advancing this on your agenda. And also I would note for Mary that often we have been on the same side, though today we are in a position of polite disagreement. I've served as an Assistant Attorney General or in other capacities with the Department of Justice since 1987. Attorney General Myers would be here today, but our budget hearings began this afternoon down in Ways and Means, and so he has commitments down there, else he would have been here himself.
Well, we can see where his priorities are.
Attorney General Frommeyer often observed that the department occupies the intersection of law and public policy, and as you all know on this committee, that's an extremely busy intersection. The orderly flow of traffic at that intersection is accomplished in great part due to the work of the Assistant Attorneys General in our department. And I don't think I would have been at the Department of Justice since 1987 if I didn't have the highest regard for the work that my colleagues do there, and if I didn't believe that what we do is really the highest calling that a public lawyer can aspire to. But to acknowledge those values is different than acknowledging that or suggesting that my colleagues should be prohibited from exercising the power of a strike. Attorney General Myers does oppose this bill, as he did in 1999 and as he did in a different version last session. This bill would enlarge the very narrow class of employees who are prohibited by law from striking. And to answer Mary's question, there are two reasons that we are opposed to this legislation. First, in our conception, collective bargaining at its best is not a confrontational process necessarily, but a collaborative one in which the parties are able to control their own destiny, to shape that kind of workplace that they have in a collaborative process that they control. The very narrow category of professions described in the statute that would be amended by this bill, the state has removed that control from the parties and placed it into the hands of a third party. The very nature of an arbitrator as opposed to a mediator is that the arbitrator tells people what the resolution is rather than helping them reach a mutually agreed upon resolution. That's a profound departure from what we think the basic conception of collective bargaining ought to be. We don't think it should be undertaken by the legislature without a very weighty justification, and frankly, we don't see one here. This existing exception is very narrowly tailored to professions in which the withholding of service is very likely to risk life or limb if the life or limb of someone who's dependent upon the services in question. And as important as our services are and as highly valued as we think they ought to be by the state, it's difficult for us to envision a case involving risk of life or limb for which we could not secure some form of alternative legal services in the event of a strike. The second reason that we are opposed to this is that we agree with the Oregon Association of Justice Attorneys, with every union for that matter, that there ought to be a remedy for an impasse if such impasse is reached in the process of negotiation. If a strike is unavailable to the union and to the employees for some reason, then arbitration ought to be provided, and that's why it exists in the statute. one of the issues that has been an uncertainty in the past in relation to this concept has been the question of whether it is ethical for a public lawyer to strike, to withhold his or her services from his or her employer. And if it were unethical, per se, for a lawyer, public lawyer, to strike, then I think Mary and I would be in the happy circumstance of being on the same side as this issue. If that were the case, then those public lawyers would have no way to break an impasse that might be reached in negotiation, because the law would prohibit a strike under those circumstances in effect. I provided you with a formal opinion by the Oregon State Bar. It's formal opinion 2000-162, and I know many of you on the committee know this, but the bar offers the service of issuing opinions as to how it believes the disciplinary rules would be applied under hypothesized facts to a hypothetical lawyer. And you'll see in that opinion that the hypothesis that is posed there is the question of whether public lawyers, including assistant attorney generals, may strike consistently with their professional responsibilities under the disciplinary code. And the short answer is that public lawyers may strike and not violate their professional obligations. Like most other public employees, they are entitled to strike or threaten to strike to advance their interests. Now, I want to acknowledge that there is some uncertainty still, even in that opinion, about the scope of the public lawyer's disciplinary responsibilities under the disciplinary code in the event of a strike. But that uncertainty resides in the burdens that the public lawyer planning to strike would shoulder as part of the transition between working and withholding services. As the opinion describes, public lawyers may have ethical responsibilities to make an orderly transition of the matters to which they are assigned. How that would be done consistently with the disciplinary rules would depend in part on the nature of the cases that each individual assistant attorney general was responsible for. Nevertheless, the opinion squarely holds that striking is a genuine option for our lawyers, and we think, frankly, that that option ought to be left open.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm confused because, Ms. Vodkin, I wouldn't anticipate seeing you here asking for somebody not to have the ability to strike. So it confuses me, and maybe I don't know enough about the background, but apparently this has come forward in 99 and 2001 and again in 2003. Could you maybe share with me the background, why we keep bringing this bill forward, and what instance came forward that prompted you to file this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as uncomfortable as the answer to your question will be, I will seek to respond to that question in a manner which is important.
Well, maybe you would want to explain just a little bit about the Employment Relations Board and their rules.
What I was thinking was that when we originally organized the Attorney General's, our current governor was the Attorney General, and we were unable to reach a settlement on our contract for almost 2 years. And it wasn't until the current Attorney General took office that we were finally able to reach an agreement. And at the time, the Oregon Bar did not believe that the Assistant Attorney Generals had the ability to strike because it would create an environment where they had actually abandoned their client. And their client is the state of Oregon. And so it was, in our opinion, not possible for them to strike without facing disciplinary action through the bar. It took us another year and a half to 2 years to get a formal opinion from the bar allowing us to how we probably did have the right to strike, or they did have the right to strike. But in that period, there was a gap. The Employment Relations Board is the body that kind of oversees contract bargaining, when there are disputes. And it was unclear at the time. It remains, you know, with all due respect to Mr. Shepard, I think he's absolutely right about his interpretation of the bar decision or the bar opinion. And quite frankly, we have attorney generals that are not willing to place their professional careers on the line to find out whether or not they have the right to abandon a client to seek a resolution to a contract dispute. And it places them in a very awkward and unique position of having to weigh their professional commitment against their economic or job security in the workplace. I mean, it's an untenable situation. This continues to feel to us like a minimum, middle of the road, kind of halfway for everybody that gets you where you need to be, where you can find a different way to settle your contract disputes where none can be found otherwise.
And Ms. Bodkin further wants to explain to you that folks who are prohibited from striking go through a binding arbitration process.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I misunderstood what you were asking me.
I knew about that part. I just didn't know the history behind this legislation, and you've enlightened me some. And my reading, just briefly, of this formal opinion, it's not really very clear. And I think that's what you were alluding to, Ms. Bodkin, that if these folks go out on strike, they may be found to be in violation of abandoning their client. And that does put them in a different position.
An ethical dilemma for them.
Mm-hmm. Can you respond to that, Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I would say have a little different view of the opinion. I think it's very clear that there is no automatic violation of the disciplinary rules for a public lawyer to lawfully exercise his or her right to strike. Where the only uncertainty that I see in the opinion, and I do think there is the mechanism by which this would get resolved, is as I said, in the transition from the time from the lawyer anticipating the strike, and as you know, under the Public Employee Bargaining Act, there's a lead-up time that would give the employee and employer notice of the pending action by the union, and it's in the mechanisms by which those transitions take place. How does the lawyer go about fulfilling his or her responsibilities to make sure that the matters are that his or her employer knows of the matters that are pending on his or her caseload? What are the critical deadlines that are coming up in those cases and so forth? But those are in the execution, the carrying out of the plan to strike. And they're not inherent in the nature of being a public employee lawyer. They have to do with the responsibilities that any lawyer would have in winding up his or her responsibility for a particular matter that they're no longer to be managing.
Mr. Chair, it puts us in a very interesting dilemma of asking our members to train, if you will, the strikebreakers so that the clients are adequately represented. And I think you can begin to see kind of the ethical dilemma we end up in, where you have very weighty issues that these individuals are working on that do impact the citizens of Oregon. And it's, you know, we're not asking for the right to withhold our labor. We're asking for an alternative process.
Senator Menes?
Well, Mr. Shepard, I'm trying to envision. Do you know of any time when attorneys or attorneys general have actually struck or walked off the job carrying picket signs? And
Mr. Chair, Senator Menes, no, I'm not aware of that, and that obviously hasn't occurred here in Oregon. I'm not familiar enough with the practice in other states to know the extent to which other assistant attorneys general in other states are organized.
And the practice of law is a profession.
Would you
correct, with its own responsibilities to the Judicial Department and the Oregon State Bar and those disciplines. So I'm trying to think to myself, I'm looking at the construct of this law here and the existing law with respect to police officers and firefighters and emergency management people and so on and so forth, and there's clearly an intent to try to preserve the order of the community during the midst of a crisis, et cetera, et cetera. But this is really a very different thing. It's a very different thing, but I'm trying to... I can't envision a group of attorneys or a group of professionals walking away from their clients. In an ethical, I'm saying I understand what the opinion says, that the Attorney General still is, in fact, the attorney representing the state, and therefore they've not abandoned the client. There is this orderly transition area, which I think would be quite costly. But wouldn't you think that this process of binding arbitration and a prohibition on striking would actually give a more orderly process to resolving collective bargaining issues?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I don't think that is our view, and the reason goes back to the first concern that we have about the concept, and that is that fundamentally the way we hope it's been working, and we think it's been working this way in the department, is that this has been a collaborative process, hard and fair bargaining, but a collaborative one nonetheless, that gains value from having... The final resolution gains value from being the result of the agreement of both parties. And that is a very different outcome than one obtains when an arbitrator tells parties what the resolution is. I'm not even presuming how an arbitrator would decide.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in the current construct, it's last best offer. So mm-hmm. the state would have an opportunity to present their side and their best position. Mm-hmm. The union would present their best position. And I think the way it currently works is that the arbitrator picks one side or the other.
Can't split the baby.
You can't split the baby under current law.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, that's my understanding as well. In my analysis of why it is that we don't like that process, why we think that doesn't serve the full interest that we think can be realized through collaborative bargaining, I'm not presuming an outcome. I'm not presuming to know, you know, to project ahead as to some dispute that hasn't yet arisen as to how some arbitrator hasn't yet been chosen might resolve that question. The point about the process, though, is that it results in an outcome that is imposed upon one of those parties, whereas a negotiated resolution is the joint resolution of both of those parties. And that's the kind of workplace that we want to foster.
Okay. Can you imagine bargaining for a bunch of lawyers? I know they did that down. Was it AFSCME that had Lane County DAs, and the DAs insisted on writing every stinking line of the contract, and they were arguing among themselves endlessly.
Somebody just passed me a note and said, "Remember DAs."
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I mean, this really is, Senator or Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis absolutely put his finger right on it. It's about an orderly process, and. You know, DAs are not going to get up and walk out in the middle of a murder trial. Attorney generals, assistant attorney generals are not going to get up and walk out in the middle of a death penalty case. I mean, it's just, those things just aren't going to happen. And unfortunately, because they won't happen, it puts them at a terrible disadvantage because they are responsible and because they do take their ethical obligations very seriously. And quite frankly, we're trying to find a different kind of a resolution for them that does not require that they put their professional ethical beliefs on the line as opposed to what's in their best interest economically.
Well, did you have something to say, Senator Walker?
Yeah. Did I understand you indicate by reference there that district attorneys have to go through binding arbitration? Some are and mm-hmm. some aren't?
Some are not. Multnomah County's ADAs are not.
Okay.
They're DAs. ADAs.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I think in one of the earlier sessions, the bill in, I think it was 1999, included deputy district attorneys as well. They are not, as I understand it, not exempt. They are not prohibited from striking by law, but maybe as a result of contractual agreements that they have, that some are and some are not.
In 89, they had requested, or in 99, they had requested that they be included in the bill. They did not make that request this time.
Well, I think my intention would be to just hold on to this bill for a little while and let let some people in the building do some vote counting and see if it's a pursuable event. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Chairman, I'm actually inclined to support it. I would be more inclined to want to put teachers in it for the same reason, the quarterly process issue. I won't offer that. I'll state my bias here.
Okay.
Let the record show, I don't represent teachers. Yeah,
I really cannot envision a period of time in which an assistant attorney general, deputy attorney general, whatever they call it, or a group of them would actually collectively walk off of the job and abandon their clients that they've been working on and constructing research for and preparing briefs for, et cetera. I mean, no, it's possible that they could transition another attorney to the case. I just can't see them in their professional position doing that. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Well, Senator Menace, I've been involved in two strikes with the state workers in which we had this ethical dilemma, for instance, with Child Protective Service workers who felt very much a strike was abandoning their clients, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, knew that in labor disputes, you know, that's for non-strikeables, for strikeables, that's basically the end of the line, and you got to make that choice at some point. So, we've got lawyers, doctors, architects in state service that are part of OPU, and, you know, those are very tough choices for people to have to make. There's no question about it. But I actually tend to agree, too, that, from just a process standpoint, it would seem to support the process would support the bill, I think. But why don't we just sit on and see the...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have some grave doubts about this bill. I need to learn more about this process, but I'm concerned that, I think the right to strike is really a fundamental right that employees should have, and when you start taking that away and saying people can't do that because they're critical to the operation of state government, how far do you go? Senator Minnis wants to add teachers. You can just keep chipping away, and pretty soon nobody has that right anymore.
But if you talk really closely to Senator Minnis, it'd probably just be Portland teachers.
Well, no, actually, Mr. Chairman, I just think that, and I go both ways on this, because when we used to have arbitration, that was not the last best offer, and it was binding arbitration, and I thought it was an orderly process by which you ultimately came to a conclusion. And I think the dilemma in striking is that it sometimes harms both the public entity or the private entity and the union members who are out on the picket line. I was a member of the 63rd Machinist and Aerospace Worker Union for a period of time as an apprentice machinist. And making $1.63 an hour back then, and then they all went out on strike. And, I'm thinking, there's no way I'm going to be able to support myself as an apprentice. And it was tough on me personally to do that. And and I've seen some subsequent strikes, particularly in the teacher areas in Sandy and some other places. And I think overall it might have achieved the objective for the teachers and come to closure there. But it really didn't help the overall reputation of the district and the schools. And I don't think a strike by attorneys, particularly the Attorney General's office, would profit the reputation of the Attorney General's office or the State in general. So it's I kind of go back and forth. Even the last best offer issue, I know there are issues that I think need to be resolved there. I've heard it argued that it's a good thing because, and I've actually had unions back in the 80s telling me we wanted to go there. And then after 750 passed, they all reversed themselves and said they didn't want to go that way. So I get a little confused on my own.
I don't think you could get the attorneys to agree on where the picket line would be. Okay, let's close this public hearing.
Mr. Chair.
Before we get in any more trouble. And we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2052. Mr. Ellsworth, would you let folks know what that does?
Author,
Yes.
Authorizes state or local government entities to enter into agreements with the United States to perform security functions for the United States and receive compensation for those services. Requires state entities to report to the State Department of Administrative Services any agreement with the United States to provide security, and requires DAS to keep an index of such agreements. Requires state agencies entering into agreements with the United States for the furnishing of security to obtain prior approval of the Attorney General of Oregon before entering into the agreement. Declares emergency and becomes effective upon passage.
Thank you. This bill was brought to us at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary, and Mr. Shepard, again, is here to testify on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. In the aftermath of September 11th, Governor Kitzhaber asked the Attorney General to do a survey of Oregon law to ascertain where there might be gaps that were revealed in the stresses and pressures of the response to September 11th. One of those items that was identified in that survey is now embedded in House Bill 2052. The federal government passed legislation shortly after September 11th, which authorized the United States Department of Defense to enter into contracts with state and local governments to provide security for domestic Department of Defense sites, of which there are several in Oregon, and provided some federal funds for that purpose. Our review of state law suggested that a gap existed in the authority of state and local governments to enter into agreements for the purpose of providing security at those federal facilities and then receiving the funds that were available through the federal government. So what this bill does fundamentally is close that gap, authorize that to occur.
So, Mr. Shepard, would that be, would an example of that be the heightened security forces at the Portland Airport, some negotiation between the Port of Portland and the Homeland Security
Mr. Chair, I don't think that particular example would be the one where there was a deficiency in an existing law, because the Port of Portland, I don't think, would be defined as a military installation or facility. Perhaps a better example might be the air base at Klamath Falls. Clearly a military facility. Under the federal legislation, the federal government is allowed and funded to enter into agreements with state or local governments to provide security support services for facilities like that. And this bill provides a very secure statutory foundation for that to occur.
Is there any opposition to the bill, Chair?
Senator Corker and members of the committee, we're not aware of any opposition. It's been, through the Interim Judiciary Committee process, it was pretty thoroughly vetted along with the other concepts that we developed with state and local government administrators and the like, and we've not heard any opposition.
Okay. Go for it. All right.
Okay, question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you. So I read the kind of the summary of the bill, and then I read the staff measure summary, which I think is pretty much the same. The summary says requires state agencies to submit agreements to Attorney General for review. The staff measure summary says requires state agencies entering into agreements with U.S. to furnish security, furnishing to obtain prior approval of the Attorney General before entering into this agreement. Can you show me in the bill where the Attorney General plays a role? Is it a review role or is it an approval role? And just show me in the bill where that is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, Section 4 of the bill on page 2 most of that is existing law. Excuse me. And under existing law, our office is obliged, well, first of all, the agency that is entering into, a state agency entering into an agreement,
must submit the agreement to the Attorney General before the agreement may take effect. So in the first instance, it can't be effective until that review has taken place. Then we determine whether it is in proper form and compatible with the laws of Oregon. If we determine that it's improper, then we follow the procedure that's described therein.
Thank you. I had a draft that did not have the second page, so that clarifies that for me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I don't think it changes that procedure. It just makes it clear that these new agreements are subject to the existing procedure.
Thanks.
Okay, over there. All right. Close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2052.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menes.
I move House Bill 2052 to the floor of the Senate to pass recommendation unamended.
Senator Menes moves the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation unamended. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Menes?
Aye.
Chair Colbert?
Aye.
Okay, it's moved unanimously, and Senator Menes will carry it, and there's probably no need to put it on the consent.
Let's just leave it as it is. There may be some question.
Okay. All right, so we will not put it on the consent. Okay, thank you. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 2052 and, House Bill 2052, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2175. Is there anybody here from the military department? There is not. Well, I suppose
things are getting ready for something.
Yeah. Let's see what this bill does. Let's see who was brought to us. Well, this was brought by the military department, so we'll just contact them and get them here to testify. Well, that leaves us with a public hearing on House Bill 2001. Could someone see if Mr. DeLashmet or Ms. Bodkin or any of the other labor goons are out there?
I called the labor person at one time and they got mad at me.
They're not there? Huh.
No, I don't care about the bill. Let's just move this bill.
Want to just move it?
Yeah. Go into work session, Mr. Chair?
I just didn't move it.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do it. Close public hearing on 2001. We'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I'd move House Bill 2001 A and Gross to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves House Bill 2001 A and Gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Ms. Gravelli, call the roll, please.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Vice
Chairman.
Aye.
You didn't think about that?
Aye. Okay. House Bill 2001 unanimously passes to the floor of the due pass, and maybe I'll carry this one. Yeah. Okay. We're adjourned. Do you mind?